Hi, this is Dr. Bill Meyer. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. You can hear the show live every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., and there are many more podcasts for this and all our other faith radio shows available on our website. You can just go to myfaithradio.com. And thanks so much for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
He's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
And welcome. It is so great to have you with us today. Can you believe it? 6 days until Thanksgiving? That's right. Just around the corner. Have you got your turkey yet? Well, you got 6 days to do it. And, you know, as you get ready to celebrate with the turkey and the pumpkin pie, why not tell your kids about what Thanksgiving is all about, that very first Thanksgiving, which really is all about religious freedom. And we're going to be talking to the chairman of the history department at Wheaton College, Dr. Tracy McKenzie, about his incredible book, The First Thanksgiving. Who were those pilgrims? Why did they come to the New World? And what happened to them during that first 2 years? It was pretty tragic, actually, but there was some great hope that comes out of it as well. And the pilgrims can teach us some marvelous things about how to celebrate and be thankful every day of our lives for the bountiful blessings that God has given us. And we'll be talking to Tracy here in just a few minutes on the Faith Radio Network. Well, if you have little kids at home, keep them away from those energy drinks. Yeah, there is a new study out on kids and energy drinks done by the American Heart Association, and they found that of the 5,000 calls to poison control centers for energy drink exposure, 40% of them involved children under the age of 6. Can you believe that? Now, in most of those cases, the parents didn't know their kids had gotten a hold of an energy drink. Most of the calls, when parents called into poison control, they said, I'm seeing all kinds of terrible side effects, abnormal heart rhythm. Some of the kids had seizures. Can you imagine your little, you know, 4 or 5 year old child gets into the pantry and pops open an energy drink and has a seizure? Stephen Lipschultz is a pediatrician and the study author, and he has handled cases involving children who became sick after consuming energy drinks. And he says, if you look at the medical research, teenagers can actually experience serious problems after drinking only 100 milligrams of caffeine. Younger kids feel the effects after drinking even less, but most energy drinks contain more than 300 milligrams of caffeine. And they also may include a variety of so-called natural additives. And there are some earlier studies that show that those combinations of these natural additives and caffeine can cause even more problems for people. Dr. Lipschultz believes the number of cases associated with energy drinks and kids is actually a lot higher than the Heart Association found in this study. That's because parents of children who get sick after consuming too much caffeine don't always call poison control. A lot of times they go right to the emergency room, and those stats weren't even included. Now, here's the sad thing. The Food and Drug Administration doesn't even set a standard for what's considered a safe amount of caffeine for children. But the American Academy of Pediatrics says that kids, little kids, should not consume any caffeine, even though, according to their research, about 73% of American children consume some caffeine every day. And you know what it typically is? Yeah, it's a Coke. It's a Dr. Pepper. It's a Mountain Dew. Children and adolescents are the fastest growing population of caffeine users. I'm stunned. Last week, I was at church, and I'm getting some coffee. Yes, I'm a coffee drinker. I don't overindulge. But I was having a cup of coffee up at the little coffee station, and this little, I think she must have been an eight-year-old girl, comes up, gets herself a nice big cup of regular coffee, puts her Coffee Mate in there and her sugar, Walks back to mom and dad, starts drinking it. Now, I didn't say anything, but I'm thinking to myself, okay, she's probably 8 at the most. Why in heaven's name are her mom and dad allowing her to have a cup of coffee at church on Sunday morning? But more and more parents, and you know, you see parents all the time in Starbucks and their kids are having Frappuccinos, which I think has a double shot, and it doesn't. I know mochas have probably 2 shots of espresso in it. So mom and dad, okay, listen up. American Academy of Pediatrics, that's your child's doctor. They say kids should not have any caffeine at all. And boy, you keep those teenagers away from those energy drinks too, because that's certainly not safe. And more kids are combining now alcohol and energy drinks in this just bizarre combination. So they're getting drunk and getting buzzed at the same time, which that can't be good if they get behind a wheel. We know that. Well, did you know that Barbie wants to be a computer engineer? Did I grab your attention with that one? Yes, Barbie wants to be a computer engineer. The only trouble is she needs a man to help her with all that technical stuff. There's this new book out. It's called Barbie, I Can Be a Computer Engineer. It's written for little girls, maybe 5, 6, 7 years of age. But it's being criticized because Barbie needs the assistance of 2 male friends to help her solve her computer problems. In one part of the book, Barbie tells her sister, I'm only creating the design ideas. I'll need Steven and Brian's help to turn it into a real game. Well, then the plot thickens when a computer virus infects Barbie's system. But, well, Steven and Brian come to the rescue. And Steven says, it will go faster if Brian and I help. And then the 2 boys fix the computer problem for Barbie. Now, that book has received some not-so-positive comments on Amazon. One reviewer said, as a computer engineer and the father of 2 daughters who are both in science and technology fields, my only recommendation for this book would be to set it on fire. Love that. A woman named Karen from Silicon Valley wrote in. She said, I thought Barbie had moved beyond her math is hard days, but apparently being a computer engineer is easy because, well, she lets Brian and Steven do all the work. So they talked to somebody at, I guess it's Mattel who makes Barbie. Lori Pantel is the vice president of global brand marketing for Barbie. She says, well, the book was originally published in 2010, and since that time, the company has reworked the Barbie books, but somehow this one slipped through the cracks. She says, the portrayal of Barbie in this story doesn't reflect the brand's vision for what Barbie stands for. All Barbie titles moving forward will be written to inspire girls' imaginations and portray an empowered Barbie character. Well, thank goodness for that. That's all I could say. My 7-year-old, I confess, she's sort of starting to outgrow Barbies, but she has a wide collection, including the Barbie cruise ship, which Dad had to put together. You didn't want to know about that. That was a labor of love. Well, you are listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Bill Meyer, and coming up next, we're going to be talking about Thanksgiving, the very first Thanksgiving. And what can the pilgrims teach us about being thankful every day of our lives? That's coming up next here on the Faith Radio Network.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer Live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer Live.
Welcome back. 6 days till Thanksgiving, and today we focus on Thanksgiving and what it really means to be thankful. And our forefathers, the pilgrims who traveled to this country in search of religious freedom. Joining us to talk about that, Dr. Tracy McKenzie. He's professor and chair of the Department of History at Wheaton College. There, Tracy teaches courses in U.S. history, the Civil War, and he is the author of 2 award-winning monographs, One South Too Many, and Lincolnites and Rebels. He's also written numerous scholarly reviews and articles, including Don't Forget the Church, Reflections on the Forgotten Dimension of Our Dual Calling, in the book Confessing History, Christian Faith, and the Historian's Vocation. Tracy is committed to being an accurate historian, and today he joins us to talk about his book, The First Thanksgiving. And Tracy, welcome to Faith Radio.
Hello, Bill. I'm glad to be with you.
Now, we had you on the program last year about this same time, and I must say I learned so much about the Pilgrims and that first Thanksgiving. And today I'd like you to just sort of lay out the story for us, first of all, and then we'll talk about what the Pilgrims can teach us in our present day about what it truly means to be thankful and to count on the providence of God. First of all, tell us, Tracy, who were the Pilgrims?
Bill, when we refer to that group, the Pilgrims, usually we're talking about these 102 individuals who traveled to New England on the Mayflower in the year 1620. They represent a group that's part of a much larger drama that's unfolding in England and Europe in the 16th and 17th century. They are members, if you go back to their origins, members of the Church of England or the Anglican Church, and they gradually begin to be concerned about what they see as remnants of Catholic teaching and practice in the Anglican doctrine, ceremonies, rituals, hierarchy of priests and bishops. And first they try to reform the Anglican Church from within. Ultimately, they decide that that's not going to happen, and they come to the conclusion the Anglican Church isn't really a true church. It's not a church that they can fellowship with. So they become what we label separatists. They actually withdraw from the Anglican Church, and in so doing, they actually commit a crime both against the church and the state, since the Anglican Church is the established church, and the King of England is the head of that church. So ultimately, to escape some degree of persecution in England, they go to Holland. That takes place in 1608. That's part of the story that sometimes we forget. They spend actually 12 years in Holland in the town of Leiden. And then in 1620, for a variety of reasons, decide that it's important that they leave, and they choose North America as their destination.
Tell me about the Pilgrims' form of worship. Obviously, you say they had some concerns about the Anglican hierarchy and the form of the very liturgical form of worship. How did they worship? How would, if we went to a pilgrim service today, if we were able to travel back in time and go into one of their church services, what would we experience?
Well, first of all, we would think the service was too long, because from our perspective, it would have been considerably longer. Probably, a good part of the morning, maybe 3 hours, 4 hours would be a typical pilgrim worship service on a Sunday. You'd go back and forth between lots of psalm singing, and they typically only sang psalms. They did not sing hymns that had been authored by writers outside of the inspired writers of Scripture. Lots of psalm singing, lots of exhortation or instruction from the minister, and that would go back and forth for a considerable period of time. One of the things I find very interesting, and it's not the largest detail, but the Pilgrim's pastor, John Robinson, in Holland, talks about the proper way to pray. And one of the things he absolutely advocates is praying with your eyes open and with your head raised toward heaven, because he believed that that was a kind of movement of the body to, sort of further contemplation of God in heaven. They also were very much against prescribed prayers. Part of what they're rejecting in Anglican worship is the services in the Book of Common Prayer. They believe that prescribed prayers were cold and unfeeling, that a faith of the heart would involve sort of extemporaneous prayer. So that was very important to them.
So their prayers might be similar to what we'd experience in some evangelical churches today, rather than, let's say, a more mainline Protestant church where you have a liturgy and you're actually reciting together. It was very much extemporaneous, as you said?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Again, the prayers would probably be longer than we're accustomed to, but they would have been extemporaneous. They were quite suspicious of anything that seemed to be rehearsed.
How did the Pilgrims deal when they went to Holland? I know one of the strains they had there, that they were, many of them were farmers, they were rural people, and they were now in an urban environment. And wasn't there a concern also that perhaps their children would become assimilated in adult Dutch culture and would not follow the Pilgrim way?
you're right on both counts, Bill, when they're talking about the problems that they encounter in Holland. One of the things they're not encountering, it's important for us to remember this, one of the things they're not encountering is any kind of religious persecution. They actually have considerable freedom to worship as they think fit. But they do complain about, economic problems, what William Bradford called the, quote, the hardness of the place, by which he meant that economic opportunity was severely limited. Leiden was an incredibly rapidly growing city for its day. And by the time the pilgrims leave there, it's a city with a population of about 45,000 or so. And it's growing because the textile industry is growing by leaps and bounds. Many of the pilgrim families are earning their living by weaving textiles in their homes, in very tiny homes, pretty much working from dawn to dusk 6 days a week. And Bradford just says it's destroying their health. It's making them age early. It's disheartening their children and encouraging the older young people to look for other kinds of jobs in other parts of the continent. And so that's a concern. And then they're also concerned about many elements of Dutch culture. They believe that the Dutch are too permissive in the way they raise their children. They believe the Dutch don't really take the Sabbath as seriously as they should. And so they do believe that over the long haul, it's having a kind of corrosive effect on the strength of their family and on the faith of their children moving toward the next generation.
Hmm. So there comes a point where they decide, and was this a unanimous decision, or was there dissension among the ranks about making this voyage to the New World?
It's not a unanimous decision, not at all. And again, that's an important part of the story that we often can lose sight of. We don't know the exact numbers of the Pilgrim Congregation in Leiden, but the guess would be that it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 to 500. And ultimately, when all is said and done, only a very small fraction of the congregation decides to relocate. That's one of the reasons why the pastor of that congregation does not come to America. John Robinson stays in Holland because he believes that at least as long as the majority of his flock remains in Holland, that's where he needs to be. So they do have considerably prolonged conversations about the wisdom of this undertaking. And in the end, they sort of agree to disagree, and some will leave and some will stay. There was the hope that more of the congregation would eventually follow the pilgrims, and a few dozen do, but not a large number. So they're concerned about whether it's wise. They're concerned about whether the dangers are too great. They're concerned about a variety of things of this undertaking.
So first they have to return to England, and they have to commission some ships. And there are two ships, the Mayflower and the Speedwell. We always hear about the Mayflower. That's because the Speedwell basically couldn't hold water, huh?
Speedwell ultimately can't make the voyage. It's actually a smaller ship that the congregation itself had purchased. The Mayflower is effectively leased, if you want to think of it in that way. Speedwell doesn't make the trip, and exactly why it's not seaworthy, exactly why it's not, is something that we'll probably never know for sure. But there's at least some circumstantial evidence to suggest that it was intentionally sabotaged by the captain of the Speedwell, the individual that they had hired to oversee the voyage. Without going into all the details, he may have rigged it in such a way that when it reached a certain speed, it would begin to take on water. And so whether that's true or not, it's hard to know. But it will not make the trip. That forces the Mayflower to be more crowded than it would have been otherwise. And it also forces a certain number of those who would have come to turn back.
And that must have been heartbreaking for those families that were planning to make the voyage to the New World. As frightening and uncertain as that would have been, they now have to leave their friends, their congregation. Did they ever make it to the New World, or did they just go back to England and remain there for the remainder of their lives?
Some of them will ultimately make it. There's going to be at least two more ships that will come in the next 2 to 3 years that will carry small numbers of that original congregation, some though will never make it, and that's just—it's a part of the pilgrim story that's mostly lost to us. We don't know a lot about the lives of those who end up not being able to come to New England.
Let's talk about the voyage across the Atlantic. It takes them, I think, 66 days to make it to the eastern coast of the United States, what's now the United States. And it was not an easy journey.
That's an understatement, Bill. That's exactly right. So it is, I think it's 65 days, actually. If you do the math, that comes out to about 2 miles per hour is the average speed that they made. So it's a very rough crossing. They're making that crossing later in the year than they had planned. They have a variety of challenges that delay their departure. And so they're doing it at the very end of fall, onset of winter. The Atlantic is very rough. They're going to spend, because of that, almost the entire voyage below decks. And so you have 102 passengers in an area that's maybe 4.5, 5 feet tall, so many adults couldn't have stood up. They're crowded in the area about half the size of a basketball court today, and they're doing a 2-month-long voyage.
And it was a voyage that we none of us would want to make. And if you've ever been on a cruise ship, it certainly wasn't that. We're going to talk more. No, we're going to talk more about that voyage on the Mayflower and what those pilgrims experienced. And actually, a baby was born in that crossing, and we'll tell you about that as well. Our guest is Dr. Tracy McKenzie. He's the professor and chair of the Department of History at Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois, and the author of this wonderful book, The First Thanksgiving. Let me just heartily endorse it, a great book to get to read to your kids and tell them about the true story of the pilgrims. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more here on the Faith Radio Network. Stick with us.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And welcome back. So great to have you with us on this Saturday in the Upper Midwest. Did you know there are 2.7 million children whose fathers or mothers are incarcerated in a federal or state prison? 1 in 28 American school kids have an incarcerated parent, and approximately half of those kids are under 10 years of age. That's why Faith Radio is so proud to be involved with Project Angel Tree this year. And you can bless those little kids this Christmas. $84 will help reach 6 children with a Christmas gift, the gospel, and a message of love from their incarcerated parent. Our goal this year is to reach 1,000 kids. And you can help us reach that goal by calling a special number. Jot this down. It's 855-59-ANGEL. 855-59-ANGEL. And if you are driving, couldn't write that down, visit our website, myfaithradio.com, and find out more about Project Angel Tree. I had an opportunity several years ago to our church was involved in Angel Tree and delivered gifts to some children of an incarcerated parent and developed a relationship with that family. And so we would really encourage you this year to get involved and make a difference in the lives of these kids. Well, I'm Bill Meyer, and my guest is Tracy McKenzie. He is the chairman of the history department at Wheaton College and the author of this book, The First Thanksgiving. And Tracy, we left off on board the Mayflower. It was a very hard voyage. We had seasickness. We had other disease. They were cramped in these very tight quarters. Describe it again. You said about the size of a basketball court, over 100 people, actually more than 100 because we had the sailors as well. Tell us about the conditions on that ship.
Right. So I would start with just the size of the Mayflower, which is really not a very large ocean-going vessel at all. At its keel, which is the lowest beam at the bottom of the ship, it's about 120 feet long, which is about the distance from home plate to second base if you're a baseball fan. The pilgrims are going to be spending almost the entire voyage in what was called the tween decks, which was an area below deck but above the hold at the very bottom of the ship where the cargo was carried. It's maybe 4.5 feet high, which means that you couldn't stand up straight if you're an adult. And in that space of about half of a basketball court, 102 people are going to live. They're going to eat and sleep and interact for over 2 months. And then the crew is just going to be crowded in other places as well. So really, it's just horrific conditions. And when they do arrive on the coast of New England in November, you can imagine how incredibly thankful they are at the prospect that they might soon be able to go ashore.
Now, we had at least one death we know of about on the way over, the servant of the ship's doctor, or the pilgrim's doctor. And then also a baby was born, correct?
A baby was born. Oceanus Hopkins is his name, appropriately named, born on the way. And again, it's just impossible to imagine the conditions for that poor mother, Elizabeth Hopkins. Total lack of privacy that she would have experienced. Oceanus, unfortunately, dies during the first winter, so his part of the story is very brief.
And isn't it true that during that voyage, someone fell overboard and miraculously they got a rope to him and he was able to get pulled back onto the ship?
Right. That's another one of the lesser-known pilgrims, a man named John Howland, who goes above above deck to get some air during a storm, and the ship is pitching violently, and before he knows it, he's out in the frigid Atlantic. And it just happens that one of the lines from one of the masts is trailing in the water, and he is able to grab hold of that and is brought ashore. When I say it just happens, of course, the pilgrims would not have thought of it that way. William Bradford, as he describes it, says it pleased God that Howland's life would be spared. But one of the things that clearly comes from that is the pilgrims don't go above deck much after that. They realize that it's really taken their life in their hands to do that.
We talk about God's providence, and we're going to learn more about God's providence and some of the almost miraculous things that happened during that first year after the pilgrims landed. Let me ask you this, Tracy. Were they off course? Were they originally trying to go to the Virginia colony to join that colony? Was it an accident that they ended up in Massachusetts?
It's not their destination. That's clear. And we don't know very precisely where they expected to land from the documents that survived, but it appears that they wanted to be as far north within the domain of the what was called the Virginia Company, which was a corporation that had been authorized by the King of England to settle the eastern seacoast of North America. And their northern boundary is around the Hudson River. And so it appears that their destination was in that area. They do miscalculate, and they end up several hundred miles farther north. They briefly try to make it south. They land originally around Cape Cod. They try to turn south, and the water there is very treacherous. There's a series of shoals that make it very difficult to navigate, and they finally decide it's not going to happen. And so they will look for a home somewhere closer in that area.
Now, we're all familiar with Plymouth Rock. I've actually been there, and I'm sure you have as well, and it's not much to see. But tell us about that first exploration through the Bay of Cape Cod and some of the early, I guess we could call it, skirmishes with the local Indians.
Correct, yes. They're going to arrive in the area of Cape Cod in mid-November of 1620, and then they're going to spend approximately, give or take, 6 weeks exploring the vicinity, trying to find an appropriate place for a site for a settlement. And one of the first times that they do go ashore, they briefly encounter a group of Native Americans. And in fact, there are some exchange of arrows and musket shots without any loss of life, as far as we can tell. And that's really the only sort of face-to-face encounter that they're going to have until the very beginning of spring the following year. They will search for a location for an extended period of time. You can imagine it's right at the onset of winter in New England, you can think just how anxious they were to arrive at a location. And the location that they ultimately choose, what becomes present-day Plymouth, was a site of a Native American village that at that moment, at least, was abandoned. That area of Massachusetts had been devastated by a disease of some kind, perhaps viral hepatitis is one speculation, that had just decimated the population there. And it had left areas more or less cultivated and prepared for settlement, but uninhabited. And so the pilgrims actually see this as truthfully part of God's provision for them. They can enter into an area already sort of prepared for them.
Now, when I talked to you last year, Tracy, you said something that really struck me. And, you know, we can call it coincidence, we can call it timing, we can call it God's providence. I tend to vote for the latter. That if they had arrived a couple of years earlier, prior to whatever this disease was that took the lives of these Native Americans, it probably wouldn't have gone so well for them.
Well, it certainly changes the dynamic dramatically. We don't know for sure how badly the population had been depleted, but it may have been in some areas as much as 90% possibly of the population. And that really destabilizes relations among Native Americans. There are a variety of tribes in the area of Massachusetts and Rhode Island, and they're tribes that are engaged in rivalries themselves. And the Wampanoag, which was the group closest to Plymouth, actually has been hit among the most hard by the disease. And so they find themselves in a very weak position and very much needing an ally. And so we actually believe that one of the reasons that the Wampanoag, in some sense, are willing to cooperate with the Pilgrims is that they need them. They see in the Pilgrims a possible way of restoring a kind of balance of power in their rivalries with other tribes.
Now, were the tribes there warlike? Do we believe that if the Pilgrims had come earlier when there were full populations, that they might have been attacked and killed and there would be no Plymouth colony?
Well, yeah, of course, it's counterfactual. We're sort of imagining what might have happened if things had been different, but that's a very plausible possibility. In fact, in the book, I say the most likely Wampanoag response would have been just to drive the Pilgrims back into the ocean. I mean, by late winter of 1621, we're talking about the Pilgrim numbers depleted to about 50, and of those, in terms of you know, sort of healthy adult males, we're only talking about one to two dozen, and so they're very vulnerable. And the Wampanoag had reason to be suspicious because there had been Europeans landing in that area off and on for many years. The idea that they would have just reached out to them in some sort of cooperative way just doesn't make much sense to us.
Mm. That first winter was horrible. And when you read some of the descriptions, it's heartbreaking. Half of the Pilgrims die, many of pneumonia, severe cold, hypothermia, children dying, spouses dying. I'm just tearing up thinking about it. But describe that first winter for us.
Well, you know, the Pilgrims are arriving when they ultimately settle at Plymouth or choose that as their location. It's the 22nd of December. All right. So it's right at the beginning of winter. And it turns out to be an unusually severe one. They had expected, believe it or not, warm weather. If you just look at a globe, Plymouth is on the same line of latitude as Madrid, Spain. It's considerably south of England. And so the Pilgrims thought that it was going to be a much more temperate environment. They're not prepared for the weather that they encounter. They don't have any structures immediately to inhabit, so they're living, most of them, on board the Mayflower. And then they're coming ashore every day to work on building a settlement. But the harbor at Plymouth is so shallow that they have to moor the ship a half a mile, three-quarters of a mile out from the shore. And so every morning, the Pilgrim men, at least, are getting into that frigid water and waiting for a half a mile to three-quarters of a mile and then working all day in wet clothes. Mm-hmm. So they're dying very quickly, and as you say, they're probably dying more than anything else from some cost of that exposure to the brutal elements. So that's leading to enormous loss of life. It's going to hit adults more than children, believe it or not. It's going to hit women much more than it will affect men. There were 18 intact married couples that made the voyage in the Mayflower. There are three intact marriages by March of 1621. Mm. And so the families are just devastated. And I always think it's important to remember that, because when we talk about the actual feast in 1621 that we remember as the first Thanksgiving, it's a celebration that is dominated by orphans and widows or widowers.
Wow. Just amazing. Was there Was there a sense of despair when you read Bradford's journal and when you read the writings of those early pilgrims, the ones that did survive? Did they ever ask, has God abandoned us?
That's a good question. And we certainly, I think it's important for us to sort of imagine what that might have been like. They don't tell us a great deal. In fact, William Bradford, who writes the fullest account of the pilgrim story, his book, History of Plymouth Plantation, he doesn't say a great deal about the losses, except that they never doubt for a moment that God is sovereign over what is transpiring. One of the things that strikes me about this is I think the pilgrims' response surely was to some degree determined by the teaching that they've been receiving from the pulpit over and over and over again for years before this trial. And one of the things that teaching, I think, had cemented in their minds was that our time on earth, is always a kind of temporary abiding. It's a fleeting. It's a shadow. And the world is not our home. One of the parts of the story that we'd love to know more about that we just don't has to do with Bradford's thoughts about his own wife. His wife, Dorothy Bradford, dies herself during that first winter.
Doesn't she fall overboard off the ship?
She drowns while the ship is moored offshore. And ever after, historians have wondered about what was going on there. So there's been at least some speculation that she perhaps threw herself overboard. We don't have any evidence of that one way or the other. And Bradford really doesn't talk about it. But you just imagine how incredibly painful that had to have been. So the question, are they worried that God has abandoned them? It's something I'm sure must have entered their minds. But the thing that impresses me the most is that right about the beginning of spring of 1621, the Mayflower is preparing to return to England. Now, the Mayflower had been leased, so it doesn't belong to the pilgrims, and now the ship and the crew is going to take advantage of good weather to return home. And at that moment, any number or all of the pilgrims who had wanted could have gone with them.
Didn't the ship's captain almost plead with them and say, come back with me to England?
He suggests that they are really foolhardy to stay, but not a one will take up that offer.
And there's that famous Wyeth painting of the Mayflower on the horizon with the pilgrim standing on the hill watching the Mayflower fade into the distance and realizing that's their only lifeline back to civilization. The discussion in the last 10 minutes has been pretty depressing, I have to admit, and it is a depressing story. But something amazing happens in the March of 1621. An Indian warrior walks into the pilgrims' camp speaking a curious type of English. Tell us who that Indian was and then what happened from that point forward.
So the Indian that you're referring to, it's part of the story we always remember. There's actually two Indians in the vicinity that have some English command, but the one that we're going to remember always is Squanto. Squanto ultimately becomes a kind of interpreter, a mediary between the Wampanoag and the pilgrims that allows them to communicate, and without his services, it's hard to imagine how they would have been able to cooperate meaningfully. Squanto's story is amazing. Without going into all the details, he had been part of a tribe called the Patuxet that was settled in that area around Plymouth. He had been kidnapped, actually, by European sailors sometimes a few years earlier than this, taken to Spain, eventually freed, made his way to England, became a servant to a ship captain, and then sometime not long before the pilgrims' arrival, makes his way back to Patuxet. And there he finds that tribe has been almost completely wiped out. And he becomes, actually, more than anything, I think we would say he is a prisoner of the Wampanoag. He's not a member of their tribe, and they don't trust him. But he has learned a great deal of English in the time that he's spent in England. He can speak more or less with the Wampanoag as well. And so he's able to serve an invaluable role, really almost like a diplomat negotiating the relations between the pilgrims and the Wampanoag. He also knows the story you always are going to hear, in your childhood books. He knows something about in particular, how to harvest eels. And so he digs eels out of the riverbeds with his feet.
Yummy.
And that becomes an important source. It does become an important source of food for the pilgrims that first winter. And then he also probably helps to some degree in introducing them to Native American approaches to corn planting.
And one of those is to use fish as fertilizer, and that's what helps their maize, their corn grow, and provides part of that first harvest. We're talking to Dr. Tracy McKenzie. He is the chair of the history department at Wheaton College about his new book, or actually it's been about a year since it came out, but it's a marvelous book called The First Thanksgiving. And we're going to take a quick break, be right back with the rest of the story leading up to that feast that was held as the pilgrims celebrated God's bounty.
Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Tracy McKenzie from Wheaton College, the author of the book, The First Thanksgiving, as we get ready to celebrate Thanksgiving in just about 6 days, and remembering that first Thanksgiving and how important it was in really the foundations of this country and what we can learn from the lives and the faith of the pilgrims. Tracy, where we left off, the Indians have now developed appears to be a peaceful relationship with the pilgrims because of this one Indian named Squanto who's able to speak English to act as a translator between the tribe and the pilgrims. He also helps them learn how to plant more effectively, how to tells them where to fish, tells them how to get those lovely juicy eels out of the creek bed. And then that summer, the harvest, the plantings are successful, and by fall we actually have a celebration of, you know, what has occurred, and that they've survived, they've made it through. They've of course been devastated by losing half of their members, but they hold a 3-day, maybe longer, festival to really thank God and invite the Indians at one point to join them. So set the stage for us for that first Thanksgiving.
Important question, Bill, and I start as a historian, I start with evidence, and the reality is we don't have a lot. The whole account that we have, or total of evidence we have about the event, comes from a letter that one of the pilgrims, a man named Edward Winslow, wrote back to England sometime probably in late November of 1621. And in this fairly long letter in which he's describing their experiences over the last year or so, he includes 5 sentences about this event, total of 115 words, and those are the only 115 words that survive. And so from it, we can only conclude a few things, that there is a celebration after the harvest. We don't know exactly when it was, that it was a sign of the pilgrims' great appreciation for God's provision after such a difficult past year or so. We don't know actually much of what was on the menu. The evidence clearly tells us that there was fowl. That doesn't have to be turkey. In fact, I think probably wasn't turkey. It was probably water birds, ducks and geese and swans. And one of the other things on the menu would be venison that the Wampanoag would bring. One important point, if I could quibble a little bit, the sources actually don't say that the pilgrims invited the Wampanoag. It's a very common thing that we remember, but it doesn't say that. It says that they came among them, and that's a little bit ambiguous. But we know from other things that both Bradford and Winslow wrote that the Wampanoag very frequently just sort of came by.
Crashed the party, so to speak.
Well, in a certain sense. In fact, in the summer of 1621, when the pilgrims were so short on food, they actually sent a delegation to Massasoit, who was the Wampanoag chieftain, and basically said, we want you to know that you're welcome to come, but we cannot feed you every time that you show up. And so it's hard to know. I think we emphasize that they invited them to make it into more of a multicultural kind of celebration than perhaps it was. And the fact that the Pilgrims, it says in the source that, as Winslow puts it, he says, we exercised our arms, which means basically they showed the Pilgrims, the Wampanoag, how they could use their muskets. The fact that they brought their guns out when the Wampanoag showed up, I don't think is a coincidence.
They weren't quite on peaceful terms with
right.
that tribe. And unfortunately, of course, we know, and I know you have some concerns about some of the revisionist history, but then also some of the criticism of that supposed revisionist history. But we do see even today some public schools where Thanksgiving is really all about the Pilgrims thanking the Indians for their help. And certainly they did help them in many ways. But knowing the Pilgrims' theology, knowing how committed they were to the Lord, that festival, that feast was a Thanksgiving to God, not to the Wampanoag.
Absolutely. I mean, everything I've said about our even doubt of whether the Wampanoag were invited sort of cast doubt on the interpretation that you're talking about. The Pilgrims would have said that every good and perfect thing, like the author of Hebrews wrote, every good and perfect thing comes down from the Father. And so when they are showing gratitude for the harvest, they know the author of that plenty is their Lord in heaven.
Tracy, I hate to say it, we're just about out of time. We have about 2 minutes left, but tell us, what can we learn here in the 21st century from the life of the Pilgrims?
Well, let me just mention one thing since our time is short. I think the Pilgrims we have reduced to this one moment every fall, and Pilgrims' theology told them that Thanksgiving is something that you weave into the fabric of everyday life, and they actually believe that Thanksgivings could be called not necessarily annually at the same point in time every year, but called occasionally just because of specific circumstances where God had met in an extraordinary way a particular need in their lives. So they're going to have Thanksgivings in the summer, they're going to have Thanksgivings in the fall, but other times of year. And when we trace the Plymouth colony through the rest of the 17th century, there's no particular correlation between Thanksgiving and the autumn. And one of the things, you know, I wish I had done differently as a parent when my children were small is I would have looked for opportunities to sort of issue our own family Thanksgiving proclamation when we saw God dealing with us kindly. Because I think that prepares ourselves to look for God's active, ongoing involvement in our lives in a way that maybe reducing it to one day every certain time every year doesn't do effectively.
And that is such a beautiful statement, Tracy. I hope all of our listeners heard exactly what you said. And I know with three young kids in my own family, that's something that we want to incorporate. Listen to this quote of Plymouth Plantation, Governor William Bradford. Our fathers were Englishmen, which came over this great ocean and were ready to perish in this wilderness. But they cried unto the Lord, and he heard their voice and looked on their adversity. Let them therefore praise the Lord, because he is good, and his mercies endure forever. Happy Thanksgiving, Tracy, and thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure, Bill.
That's it for On the Faith Radio Network. We'll be back next Saturday at 11 a.m. You have a wonderful day. Neil Stavins, weekend edition of Connecting Faith, is up next. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. If you'd like more information about this show, just go to myfaithradio.com and click on the program page for Dr. Bill Meyer Live.